Thank you very much. Thank you very much for the invitation. It's actually my first time at the API. Yeah, having a good time. So I'm talking about this recent work on astrophysical probe for axion dark matter. But since actually I'm sure there are a lot of people here working on axion.
Oops.
So what happens? Oh, okay. just a transition, temporary transition. Okay. So since a lot of people here work on axion physics, have done interesting, important work on axion physics. So I would just start with a very quick overview of basic axion physics. So is there a pointer or something? Okay, anyway, I could just use my finger.
Hockey stick. Round.
Oh. Very Euclidean, very Euclidean. Okay, great. So what is an axion? So axion is a periodic pseudoscalar field. It lives on a circle with a periodicity FA, decay constant FA. So it has a wide range of phenomenological applications. So the most famous one, as everyone knows, is the QCD axion as a leading solution to a strong CP problem. Here, just took a cartoon from Anson Cook's classy lecture. So this is a classic picture of a neutron. So the strong constraints on the neutron EDM actually tells us this eta angle here has to be tiny. So the one explanation is to promote the theta angle to a dynamical field, the QC axion. So relax itself to this minimal energy configuration with zero EDM. So there are many other possible applications for general axion-like particles. Just quickly mention a few examples. For example, the axion-like particles could serve as candidates for inflaton, as realized in the lateral inflation and axion monodromy models. And both QC axion and general axion-like particles could serve as cold dark matter candidates. This axion could oscillate coherently around the minimized potential and the coherent oscillations redshift as cold dark matter. Related to some recently revived experimental anomaly, the muon magnetic moment, so heavy axion with couplings to muons and photons could potentially provide an explanation to G-2. Okay. So there are multiple directions. There are multiple directions for the axion study. Okay, so the here when I talk about axion, I refer to general axion-like particle, and as well as QCD axion. So one could build new models to go beyond the vanilla models to open up new parameter space and possibly identify new signals. And there has been a lot of important developments in the constructing terrestrial experiments, DM radio, and so on. Last but not least, there has also been many interesting proposals to probe axion with astrophysical or cosmological data, either using the early universe data or the later universe data. So for this talk, actually, as I already mentioned, I'm going to talk about a new astrophysical probe of axion dark matter, more precisely the electromagnetic coupling of axion dark matter. So this is like along the third direction. So this is this work is done with Manuel Bambet, who is now a postdoc at Maryland, and Chen Sun, who is now a postdoc at Tel Aviv. So near the completion of our project, we learned quite accidentally that there's a larger group at MIT and McGill working on the same topic. So we actually coordinated with each other, and both papers appeared on the same day near the end of last year. Okay. So the axion coupling we want to probe is axion photon coupling. So the AFF dual. So A is axion, F is the field strength of U1 electromagnetism. Okay. So it's usually parameterized this way. So this GA gamma gamma is dimensionful, has energy dimension minus one. So it's inversely proportional to the decay constant. So this coupling could lead to many interesting phenomena. So the, for instance, it could lead to the spontaneous decay of the axion. So let's consider axion at rest. So this coupling could induce the axion to decay to two photons. So the two photons will go back to back due to momentum conservation, and each photon carry energy half of the axion mass. Okay, so for a very light axion, like that's relevant for astrophysical studies, this J-gamma coupling, the axion photon coupling, is small. So this decay rate is usually very tiny. So but this decay could be enhanced if we consider stimulated decay scenarios. So say let's have some external source, this blue dots here, okay, and emits like some extra some flux of photons. So if this external photons mass energy matches half of the axion mass, actually it could enhance the decay rate of the axion. Okay, so this is analogous to the laser. So here the decay rate will be enhanced by the large occupation number of this external photon flux. So the idea is actually the general direction is to look for stimulated decays. Okay. So the actually there has already been proposals to look for stimulated decays. So by Caputo et al. So what they propose here, like let's have some source in the sky that like emit some continuum photon spectrum. So this is shown by the blue line here. So and along the line of sight between the source and us, and like when the photon external photon energy matches half of the axion half of the mass of the axion dark matter. So here I'm assuming that the dark matter is entirely axion. Okay, just some general axion-like particle. So then this will induce a stimulated decay of the axion dark matter. And so the one photon from the axion decay will go back to source, but one photon will reach us and could be collected. So to the leading order, okay, the axion dark matter at rest, so we'll get a monochrome magnetite, but of course that due to a peculiar motion of dark matter, the line will be broadened. So it will have the signal will be look like a lateral bump. So what we're actually looking for is kind of lateral bump, a very small, tiny lateral bump on top of this this continuing emission from the source. Okay. So this just looks for like the stimulated decays along the line of sight. But these stimulated decays do not just happen on this side. It actually could also happen along the continuation of line of sight on the side away from the source. Okay. So say the source photon keeps traveling and induce the stimulated decays of axion on the other side. Okay. So then so here the axion could again decay to two photons. One photon will just keep traveling and leave us. And the other photon actually kind of bounce back towards us. Okay. So this like the photons that will actually travel travel back towards us is the echo, what we call axion echo photons. So what we could do is that we can actually turn our telescope around and look in the opposite direction to try to collect these echo photons. Okay. So one obvious advantage of this approach compared to the previous, like what's shown on the previous slide, is that you will have less background. Okay. So just the signal here, the echo photons will just lead to like a lateral bump. So of course, like it's not entirely background free. There are all kinds of like emissions in the sky, but at least we won't have the background from the source. Okay. So again, this idea is has been proposed a couple of years ago, first by other Sikivi. So what he proposed is actually a terrestrial experiment. In their proposal, the source S is actually a memory source, is some very powerful microwave beam. Okay. So then they just basically proposed shooting the beam into the sky and then try to collect the echo the echo signals.
So nice question. So in why doesn't it just radiation domination, you get a lot of spontaneous decay?
Radiation domination. So you mean just in the early universe?
Or, well, maybe.
So actually,
Maybe you don't deplete, but maybe then there's a soup of KV photons.
Oh, okay. So the signal actually turns out to be strongest in the radial band. So we're talking about something like the photon energy is in the like 10 to minus 6 electron volt. So for high energy photons, what happens is that the occupation number will decrease. So the enhancement is not large enough to generate a big signal.
I see. So
one short result, you actually see that the curve kind of like looks like this. Okay, so it's kind of the sensitivity is best like in the for the 10 to minus 6, around 10 to minus 6 electron volt, and what it goes up at when the energy increases, just because of the.
It happens to be that the spontaneous decay just in radiation from radiation domination is just small.
I'm thinking of like more like the. Like for instance, like CMB photon, okay, maybe that we should take into account the redshift.
Yeah.
I'm thinking like CMB photons 10 to minus 4 electron volts. So that's that's already like the signal is already not big enough. Yeah.
Could you find us the CMB? We have like a peak at 7 kelvins. And then if we go to a smaller frequency, we have this huge rise up with.
Yeah.
So the power minus 2.7.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
This is the value you're guaranteed to have at all times, right? Unless you make angular cuts, right? So this is like the background everywhere, what's called arcade, whatever, the radio background.
The radio background will get bigger for smaller frequencies.
That's correct.
Yeah. Yes, yes. So that's why like the sensitivity goes like this. So kind of this part is because of like goes up because of the background.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, then this part is because of the decreasing occupation number. Then there are some regions like around 10 to minus 6 electron volt, it still has a decent sensitivity.
That's correct.
And angular cuts or no angular cuts?
So
in this region where arcade access starts, right? This one.
Yeah.
To be in the middle. Well, so x of 10 to 1 is 3 relative to the peak of the CMB.
I think
omega over t is 10 minus 3. That's where it starts. It starts growing up very, very much so.
Okay, maybe I don't completely catch your answer to the question, but I will talk about the background.
The lowest frequency range, right?
You want to be in the low frequency range, but also like so
the CMB and background, right?
So there's still some radio background here, but sure.
And it's called arcade because the only instrument that measures it is called arcade.
Sorry, the instrument I'm going to show is SKA.
SKA?
Yeah.
It doesn't exist.
Yeah, it doesn't exist. Okay. And we're talking about projected sensitivity.
I'm telling you what.
Yeah. Okay. But I think, okay, we didn't study it, but okay. So we actually, each group actually like studies complement each other. So the other group actually studied FAST. This big dish telescope, radio telescope in China. And they actually, their conclusion is that for FAST, they already have some sensitivity.
Yeah.
Right. So I'm not, it's very interesting proposal, Securis et al.'s proposal, but I'm not totally sure how feasible it is and what status this proposal is. So then Gosch et al. Actually proposed that instead of like having a man-made like a source, we could consider the source to be like something astrophysical object that already exists in sky. So what do you consider is the source a Cygnus A radio galaxy. So this is one of the most powerful constant radio sources in the sky. Okay. So what new did we do? So what we realized is there's one feature of these axion echoes that hasn't been pointed out in these two papers. That is, this axion echoes is really from the entire history of the source. What do I mean by that? So let's look at this like schematic picture. So here, like the vertical direction just denotes the flow of time, and the horizontal direction is the line of sight direction. So let's consider source emits like a sequence of pulses over the time. So then, so these are shown by this blue bumps here. So they say the source photons emitted at earlier times were like go past us and travel over longer distance before it generates stimulate decay of the axion dark matter, and then the echo photon will come back to us. And the source photon actually emitted at later times will travel a short distance past us before it induces an echo photon. But these echo photons were generated at different locations and induced by the source photon emitted at different times could come back at us, be collected by us at the same time. So in other words, our signal we could like collect like a given time, a TO, is really a stack of these echo photons, which are like induced by the source photons emitted at different times. So the punchline here, just the signal is really integration over the entire history of the source. Okay. So this actually feature of the axion echo signal actually opens up an interesting new possibility for the source. So we could consider dim O source, like which could maybe barely visible. When I say visible, I mean barely detectable today, but could be used to be very bright in the past. And this could still lead to a strong signal, just because the big past flux could generate a big like flux of the echo photons. Okay, so that's the basic idea. Right, so before talking about the source further, let me just first show you more details about the signal and how to compute the signal. Okay. So the signal strength depends on the flux density of the echo photons that could be observed today. So one could derive it from the standard Boltzmann equation. So here F gamma is the photon free space density, and C is some like collision terms. Okay, this is a pretty standard computation for the. So here, these are all the free space like integrations, and M squared is the average matrix element squared. And then here, just again, this small f's are phase space density associated with axia and photons. So this takes into account, this one takes into account spontaneous decay, and then the other two terms takes into account stimulated decay, and this minus f1, f2 takes into account of the reverse process where the two photons meet in the median to produce an axia. Okay. So then could one compute the phase space density of the axion and then integrate over solid angle to get to the flux density. So as I mentioned, that to the leading order axion is at rest. So then the frequency of the echo photons is at like related to the photon energy, which is like half of the axion mass. Okay, but of course that the motion of the axion actually will like broaden the line, so that leads to a bandwidth, which is delta, what I call delta nu here, which is actually determined by the dark matter peculiar velocity dispersion. Okay, so just do this integration for the collision terms, and then solve the Boltzmann equation and find that the average flux density of these echo photons goes like this, okay. So let me first just explain the prefectures, okay. Actually, probably I just want to draw your attention to the most important quantity in the prefecture, is gamma in here, which is the axion spontaneous decay width, which depends on the fundamental parameters, the axion mass, axion photon coupling. So basically the signal's dependence on this fundamental parameters is through gamma A. So what is more important for the signal computation is this integration along the continuation of line of sight. So let me say a few words about that. So this integration is along the continuation of line of sight. It starts from zero. So zero just means our location, okay? So our position. Okay, so we're working in natural units. So the time and age distance, time and distance actually have the same unit. So we start from integration from where we are all the way to the distance of half of the age of the source. So the reason is half is just because the echo photons need to travel over the same distance as the source photon to arrive at us today. Okay, so just to give you some idea, quantitative idea, how big that is. So this TH, for the source I'm going to show you, has a lifetime about 10 to the 4 to 10 to the 5th years. So it corresponds to a distance of about 10 kiloparsec. So so 10 kiloparsec. So then this integration along the line side depends on the dark matter density, this rho A here. Then it depends on the external photon flux density. Okay, I said it's a stimulated decay, so the decay rate will be enhanced by the external photon flux density. So, but notice the argument here is TH minus 2X. So this means just this, this is source flux density at an earlier time. The reason for that is just the each echo photon, emitted a distance x away from us, was produced because of this was produced by light. The first process at a time 2x away. So we need the source photon travel with this x, distance x, and then echo photon you travel with same distance to reach us today. So that's why it's this echo photon corresponds to the source photon emitted. At 2h minus 2x. Okay. So lastly, we need to take into account of absorption of the photons along the line of sight. So that's encoded by this optical depth, tau. Okay. Turns out that this is important when we are close to the Galilei center, but if the echo photons are not from the Galilei center, that this actually exponential is close to one. So we can safely ignore it.
So okay. Naive question, isn't there dependence on the angular emission?
So that's a good question. So that's I skipped one step here. So the photon free space density, so we integrate over the solid angle. So basically the source has a size. So the image actually also the echo photon, the image also have a size. So we actually integrate with a solid angle when we ignore the dark relative motion of a dark matter and the source, it's just integrated with a solid angle of the extended by the source. So so from here to here we actually already do an angular integration.
For the stimulated emission, isn't there a non-trivial, because I mean, you can look at exactly opposite from you, or you can look a little bit.
Oh, that's a good question. So, okay, if we forget about the motion of the dark matter and the source, yes, you just look at exactly the opposite direction. But that's what I want to talk about next. So there is some, because we know the dark matter moves relative to the source. So there is some effect of dark matter peculiar motion. So that's what we'll discuss on this slide. Okay, so maybe you could ask again if this slide doesn't address your question. Okay. So since Matthias already mentioned that, let me discuss that. So So the angular size, one angular size that matters is like the source size. Okay, the source actually extends, like it's not just a dot, a point source. It's actually has a size. But one also needs to take into account like the relative motion between the dark matter and the source, in particular the dark matter peculiar motion. So this actually could be potentially dangerous for the signal. So the reason is this. So say let's consider look at the left panel. So there's the echo photon without a dark matter peculiar motion will follow this dashed like red line. So will hit us. So this O here. This is the, us. The echo signal have a telescope here. But due to the peculiar motion, let's just consider peculiar motion in the transverse direction. So the echo photon will actually the echo photon will actually depart from this route, and then it would move in the transverse direction over distance, like set by this angle theta, which is like set by the peculiar motion, which peculiar velocity, which is of order 10^-3 for dark matter in our galaxy. So then the echo photon will just completely miss the telescope. So we cannot collect it. So what we could do to overcome this difficulty is really just to enlarge the collecting solid angle to collect photons from nearby. So the idea is that the without peculiar motion, again, there is echo photon following the dashed red line. Okay, so that will not be able to reach us. But with the peculiar motion, this echo photon nearby could hit us. Okay, so if we look for a bigger part of sky, so this angle is delta, and we could also estimate the size of delta, the collecting solid angle we need to need to take into account in order to overcome this effect of dark matter peculiar motion. So this delta turns out to be proportional to the dark matter peculiar velocity, and also the characteristic length scale this echo photon will travel, which is set by the age of the source, half of the age of source, and also divided by this d, the distance between the source and us. So putting some characteristic values for these quantities, one could estimate so that the solid angle we collecting solid angle will lead. Is of order 10 arc minute. So compared to the source size, characteristic source size, we'll talk more about source shortly. So this is actually comparable. Okay. So basically, what we're saying is that in the end, so the collecting solid angle is set by kind of the maximum of the source size or this size we need in order to overcome the peculiar motion. Okay. Is that
just one even simpler aspect, like the simulated decay, is it completely trivial, the angular emission?
I think we are thinking it's really the direction to the in the it's really along the continuation of line side, so it really angular
emission on that direction as likely as the emission backwards. Yes.
Yeah. So we're it's basically so when we think ignore the dark matter motion, it's the one is going that so it could emit in different directions, but we only care about this particular direction along the line of sight.
Okay, I guess I was missing the fact that it's two.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. So this is a schematic picture I mentioned at the beginning. So now let's talk about the source. So the source we're now looking for is not some constant source, it's some time-varying source. I said we want to explore the possibility of some dim source that was very bright. So literature does provide such a kind of source, that supernovae remnants. So supernova is a powerful stellar expansion explosion. Okay, so this is just an artistic image of a recent supernova explosion. Here is the light curve of supernova remnants. So after explosion, the supernova just keeps expanding till it merges with interstellar media. So here shows the luminosity as a function of time. Okay. So there are actually there are four phases for the after explosion for the supernova remnants, which actually is now some standard radio astronomy textbook stuff. Okay. So the what matters for study is only the first two phases when supernova is very bright, was very bright. So the first phase is called free expansion phase, where the super after explosion, okay, then the luminosity of a supernova just rises up exponentially fast. So it reaches some peak luminosity at some peak time, okay? And then after it keeps expanding, then the luminosity starts to fall, following some power law, okay? And then at some transition time, it will just keep the luminosity keep falling, but following a different power law, okay? So then we enter the second phase, the so-called adiabatic phase. So you can see the light curve model is basically parametrized by three parameters, L peak luminosity, L peak, peak time, and transition time. Okay. So the spectrum of the supernova actually also follows some simple power law. And it goes like the photon energy to some power minus alpha. Alpha is the spectral index. And yeah, actually, this is from the data. So it peaks around 0.5 and has a spread. Okay. So I want to talk a little bit about this more astronomical stuff, like about these two phases, because it could help us understand the results. So for the first phase, this free expansion phase, the shockwave expands with a radius scaling like time, the time elapsed after explosion. So before the power law falling, this optical depth due to the free absorption and the synchrotron radiation drops over time. That's the reason for this exponential rise in the luminosity. So this phase can last for about a few hundred years. So this phase was purely parameterized this way. So the luminosity anchoring around the peak luminosity, as like then there's an exponential term that takes into account of this exponential rise. And then there's a power law term that takes into account of this power law falling after peak luminosity reached. So so there has been studies by astronomers, Bickenholz et al. Like what they do is a statistical studies, like using about 100 young supernovae in the radio band, and then they find the mean value and standard deviations for the peak luminosity, and then the peak time. Okay, later, when we try to show the sensitivity's dependence on the parameters, I will refer to this paper again. Okay, the key point here just that. From using the data set of the recent young supernovae, where we could actually measure the like the light curve, like there are some like upper bounds, like some mean value, some statistical studies of these parameters. So they cannot be, in principle, they cannot be arbitrary. Okay. So in the second phase, this adiabatic expansion phase. So there's some approximate energy conservation. So the pressure behind the shock waves push away the surrounding material. So there's some hydrodynamic estimates show that in this case, the radius scale, like the time to two phase power. So this can last for a few 10,000 years. So this phase, the luminosity follows some simple power law. Okay. So if you anchor it like at the luminosity at the transition time, and then this luminosity falls off at some point now, where this power actually related to the spectral index. Okay, if the supernova remnant is still in the second phase, then there's a different parameterization anchoring around the luminosity today. I won't go into that. They're just equivalent parameterization. So now let me see a little bit more about this observed supernova remnants. Okay. So far, about 300 supernova remnants have been observed and collected in this so-called green catalog. So there's a different catalog, SNR CAT, that includes age estimates for some of the supernova remnants. Actually, the age is important input for a computation of the signal. So the So actually, the supernova remnant formation rate is estimated to be about 0.02 to 0.3 per year. So over the time scale of 10 to the 5 years, we actually expect about 2,000 to 3,000 supernova remnants in our Milky Way. So there's a deficit here between the observed number and that's sort of what we expect. So the deficit could be just due to like some selection criteria on identify the supernova remnant. So if the surface brightness of a supernova remnant is low, or the angular size is too extended because the supernova remnant like expands too much, and then this it may not be identified. Right. So this is about the the source. Okay. So the now let's talk about the instrument for observation. Okay, so well, we actually just consider the square kilometer array, SK, phase one, as the example for study. So SK was supposed to be constructed from last year, scheduled to be constructed from last year, but I don't know where they actually started due to the pandemic. Okay. So the so SK could probe two frequency range. So one is like relative low frequency range from 50 megahertz to 350 megahertz. So then there's K1 mid, which is around slightly higher frequency between 350 all the way up to 15 gigahertz. So so I want to say a little bit about the two operational modes for the radio telescope. There is the single dish mode. In this case, it's just the ULIT detection ULIT. So actually, as the lamp suggests that here, the square kilometer array has like is a array of many telescopes. So the single dish mode, the detection ULIT, just is like each telescope or each station in this array. So in this case, the angular resolution is set by the diameter of the dish, the small d here. Okay. So then there is the interferometer mode. So in the interferometer mode, basically we pair up the telescopes in the telescope array. So basically the detection ULIT in this case is two element interferometer. So in this case, angular resolution is set by the baseline, okay, the capital B here. So the baseline is just separation between two telescopes. So certainly the baseline will be larger than the diameter of the single dish. So that that means that in the interferometer mode will have a finer resolution. So that's one advantage of the interferometer mode over the single dish mode. But this advantage of the interferometer mode also comes with a disadvantage. That is, if we consider an extended signal, with size above this resolution, and the interferometer mode will fail to detect it. So the reason is actually similar to the double slit experiment. If you actually have extended this photon source, actually you will not see the interference pattern in a double slit experiment. So so this actually is important for us to understand our results. So as the frequency increases, also the angular resolution will get smaller for the interferometer mode. But then the number of baselines that contribute to the detection for a given signal could decrease just because some of the baselines will have too smaller angular resolution to detect an extended object. So for extended object, single dish mode will actually still have an advantage. Okay. So one more thing about this operational mode. So since we're talking about a large number of telescopes in the array, so for single dish mode, the signal to noise ratio will be enhanced by square root of n if there are n single dishes, okay? But for interferometer mode, we'll actually get a big enhancement just because for n telescopes in the array, we'll have order n squared, like pairs of telescopes. So then the signal to noise ratio will be enhanced by roughly a factor of n, which is a lot of advantage of interferometer mode compared to single dish. So again, the upshot here, just for detection, we actually lead both modes. So before showing the result, just comment on signal to noise ratio, that's the figure of merit for the setting the sensitivity, projected sensitivity. So signal power is proportional to the average flux density, okay? That's the and also total collecting area, okay? Delta nu is just the bandwidth. And the noise power is actually determined dominantly by this T-sys here. So T-sys is just a systematic, a system noise temperature. So it combines contribution from like the telescope, the telescope temperature itself, and also CMB temperature, and also the synchrotron background from the Milky Way or extragalactic source. Actually, in our case, it's dominated, the background is dominated by the synchrotron background. Okay. And of course, it's the noise will be inversely proportional to observation time. The longer observation time is, the noise also will be reduced. So we take like to be like observation time to be about 100 hours. Okay. So here's.
Sorry, just before, what's the integration time of the flux?
So the integration time is actually the flux is determined by the age of the source. So.
Oh no, but I mean like when you get the source will presumably give you this large flux of photons.
Yeah.
And dims down over time. How long does that take? Is it 10 seconds more?
Oh, is it, so.
In that plot that you have?
Yeah. Okay, yes. So here actually mentioned, so this actually will show you the free expansion phase lasts about a few hundred years.
Oh, I see.
So this one lasts like to about 10,000 years. And I'll show you actually this phase will be the dominant contribution.
Uh-huh.
So it's basically just a few hundred years, but the point is that it lasts for a few hundred years, but it was in the past, so it's So basically what we do is we kind of like survey all the supernova remnants that. In these two existing catalogs with known age. So then this is the one that will give the biggest echo flux, echo photon flux. So here shows the projecting sensitivity for SK1 as kind of benchmark for in the axial mass and the axial photon coupling pair. Okay. So the green regions are the existing constraints. Okay, so I'll talk about uncertainty in a minute. So right now we just fix the supernova parameter. So this blue line and this red line are the projected sensitivity. So the blue line just only considers the contributions of echo photon from the second phase of the supernova remnant. That is this adiabatic phase, just the power law falling, and the red line actually consider contribution from both phases, the first phase with its exponential rise and also the second phase. So you could see that clearly the contribution is mostly from the first phase, okay? And the sensitivity, I said, like has is the best and comparable in the axial mass around 10 to minus 6 electron volt, corresponding to frequency about 0.1 gigahertz. So you could see already mentioned at the beginning. So the shape of this curve is that this rise to the at higher frequencies is the signal actually will decrease just because of the occupation number of the external photon flux will decrease. And then there's some rise for the low frequency. It's really due to the rising background. Okay. So she mentioned that this supernova remnant, which is not very famous, is not among the brightest radio source today. Actually, the brightest extrasolar radio source with frequency, like actually around and above 1 gigahertz, is also a supernova remnant. It's called Cassiopeia A, but it's a young one. It's 340 years. So today's luminosity of this brightest one is about 30 times as large as this old one. But the reason that the old one actually this young one, as I'll show you shortly, is really that it's past the flux is significant. Okay, so also she mentioned that so for the low frequency, the sensitivity dominantly comes from the interferometer mode, okay, because mostly due to it will have a bigger signal to noise ratio enhancement and final resolution. But for high frequency, because of the interferometer mode, will fail to detect extended object. So its resolution becomes smaller, and then it will be more difficult for the interferometer to see extended object. So then the single dish mode dominates.
Can I ask a question? So if I ask the flux, let's say I have two sources at the same location.
Okay.
Same distance away from us, and then they have different age.
Okay.
How does the flux depend on this age parameter? If I have a bunch of sources at the same location, which one contribute the most? Same brightness, everything.
So you mean same brightness today or?
No, basically the same source. It has this flux which goes up and down, right?
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if it is always at that location, what is the time that it will give me the best signal flux on the age of the object?
So from this master formula, so what we could kind of see is that, okay, so it's really a weighted integration. So it's, of course, I think, so what matters is that which combination here, it's in a range, right? So it's, it's the brightest part. Unless you're probing into this wavefront goes into the dark matter, less dense regions. Let's assume that this let's just say dark matter density roughly uniform.
Yeah.
So then it's really just determined by the range, both determined by the peak flux you could get, and also I'm saying if you treat this as roughly uniform, so then this integration just forget about this. Then it justly depends on it's basically roughly the age of a source times this integration just this past the flux.
Yeah, so I'm wondering when does it how does that function look like when you integrate as a function of TA? Is there sweet spot? The older the source is the better.
There's kind of sweet spot, okay, for the age around 10 to 40, 10 to 5. If the age is above, say 10 to the 5, 4 to 10 to 5 years, what will happen is that the wavefront of the early photons, with the biggest flux, will actually already move to the or travel over longer distance, 10 kiloparsec. So already moving to the region where there's less dark matter.
Okay.
So then you'll suffer from this, you cannot treat dark matter density as uniform. You'll suffer from the smaller dark matter density.
Okay.
So for shorter, smaller age, smaller age, I think that that actually that's it was the thing you suffer from, like a smaller integration range. Just like the I think this one is the dominant one, that you need to have a big like luminosity. But somehow there is still a sweet spot in this range, just because like longer that you this you'll be penalized by the smaller dark matter density because the wavefront goes too far away from us. And for shorter one, you will suffer from this at least for the Cassiopeia A, it will suffer from both the smaller peak luminosity and as well as the smaller distance, the smaller lines integration range.
Now, but how much is the decay enhanced with respect to just decay with in the absence of spontaneous of a stimulated decay? So from how much are you winning from the stimulated thing with respect to normal decay of the axons?
We're saying the normal decay is impossible. I don't know the number. Like normal decay is tiny. It's very tiny.
Much than.
I guess the question is, what is the parametric dependence on gamma A?
So
also,
how large is the photon occupation number?
Yeah, the photon occupation number, I need to look at it at the beginning. It could be huge. Yeah, I don't remember the number. It's huge.
So you're very, very large. So
yeah.
What I'm wondering is, do you actually deplete dark matter in any region of the sky?
No, it's not definitely not at large, not to the level of depleting the axion dark matter.
And I guess if you did, you'd also lose photons on the way, right?
Yeah, but the energy is coming from the dark matter anyways.
Yeah. I don't remember the number of head, but definitely we check that. That's certainly not enough to deplete dark matter. So it's still a small signal.
Okay.
Sorry, another question.
Yeah.
Your sensitivity plot, you were considering one source, just looking at one source.
Just the one source.
Would you get relating the signal because you know the direction of the different sources?
Cave stack.
Yeah. Okay, that's a good question. So, we didn't do that. The thing that if you know, the one reason is that there are only two supernova remnants that could give give similar sensitivities. And then this among these two, like one is actually this SKA could only point to south part of the north north part of sky. So the other one will give signal like in the region like SKA cannot detect. So it could not even combine these two.
Let's see.
So if you combine just the weaker signals, that's mostly driven the sensitivity mostly driven by the strongest one.
Yeah, because before you mentioned some 200 sources.
Yeah. So yes, it's 200. But I think this one is other than two. I think the other ones are all kind of significantly the flux signal flux is significantly weaker compared to these two. And these two, one of them said, it's like the signal is in the wrong part of the sky for the SK.
Thanks.
So let me mention some uncertainties. So the light curve model is basically like has three parameters. So if we fix two parameters, the last one is determined. So here I show you the sensitivity in the transition time and peak time plan. So the green regions are the the sensitivity to photon coupling. So the lighter the green is, the more sensitive we have. So so it's a busy plot. But okay. So you could see first the thing that for the sensitivity, you could see it's almost this contour is almost horizontal. So it just when it varies, change transition times, and the sensitivity doesn't change much. Okay. So then there are these red lines. Okay. So the red solid line is the mean value T peak again from this earlier reference I mentioned. This doing the statistic study over about 100 young supernova, and they find the mean value, and then this dash and dotted are the one sigma, two sigma ranges of the T peak. Okay. And also see that this purple contours, there are two sigma and three sigma upper ends of the peak luminosity. Okay. So so the point here is that so for the sensitivity contours I showed you, we pick like transition time and peak time to be here by the represented by the star. So you could see that at here that we choose the peak time to be already two sigma away from the mean value. And the peak luminosity is already close to three sigma upper end from this study based on the Young supernovae. Okay. So if we actually try to get closer, change T peak to be closer to the mean value, actually the luminosity will actually, peak luminosity will increase. Actually sensitivity will also increase. So the point of this plot is just say, this O supernova, one reason for this O supernova to be give the strongest signal is really it's a typical bright source in the past. Its peak luminosity based on like the its light curve model with three parameters is really huge. Okay. So then you could also consider other uncertainties, like for the, you could consider the conservative projected sensitivities with contribution from second phase and vary the relevant parameters. So like for age, spectral index, transition time. So the largest uncertainty comes from the spectral index, which is also sort of expected just because the spectral index enters in the power. So if you change your power, you affect the signal strength by quite a bit. So lastly, just so that what I show you just like for the old, very old supernova. So we could also consider of course, people keep looking for supernova and supernova remnants. So I want to show you like a kind of hypothetic young supernova, see what kind of young supernova could lead to, could give some sensitivity. So here we just make up some benchmark for young supernovae. So like close to us, the distance that could potentially be discovered in the future. So the key property of this young supernova makeup is that its flux density actually today is comparable, like not today, flux density like that we'll observe it will be comparable to the solar burst. So it's very bright, okay? So if there's such kind of young bright supernova that could be discovered in the future, it could also lead to an echo like a signal. And in this case, we also just need to use interferent mid mode. Just because this young supernova is pretty small, it hasn't expanded yet. So it's a tiny source. So then the interferent mode works the best.
Sorry, and how bright is Sagittarius in the radio?
Huh?
Just the Sagittarius, how bright is it, the black hole? Radio, isn't it much brighter than this in radio? I don't know.
Isn't it the thing about our black hole that it's not bright at all?
But how bright is it in radio? And in radio, I thought it was pretty bright. I mean, that's how we...
But that's, I don't know that how bright, I don't know how bright it is, but the one thing that here helps that you're actually looking, you know the solar direction of the signal. So basically you look for this case, this one, you actually, you know where the supernova remnant, you look in the opposite direction.
Yep.
So the background is really from region of interest is about 1 degree in the opposite direction. So
we know where's the black hole, right? It's in the center of the galaxy. So you look in the other way.
Yeah, I guess most supernovas will be like towards galaxies.
Yeah.
So you always look opposite.
Yeah.
What you want to suggest is instead of looking at the photons from a supernova, you want to use the photons from the black hole?
Yeah.
Oh, I see. Interesting.
Yes, because I mean that's how we know that there's a black hole there because it's a radio source.
Uh-huh.
So I will naively have guessed that the luminosity is much larger than 10 to the 30 hertz per second.
I'm not sure.
I'm not sure.
It's like such a bright source.
I'm not sure. So there is actually, if you check Wikipedia, there is a list of radio sources.
Oh, I see.
So
it's not there.
I don't remember. It's probably there. It's definitely not the brightest one.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. So let me just summarize. So we'll show you just some axion echoes from type varying sources, such as supernova remnant is a possible way to probe axion dark matter is coupling to photons. I didn't show it, but this actually sensitivity could be better than constant sources, such as from Cygnus A. So the signal is, again, just a recap, like it's in the opposite direction of the source. It could be from an old dim source, which was bright in the past. So looking forward to future, so certainly that this signal calculation depends a lot on this the modeling of a supernova light curve. So like understanding better this peak time, peak luminosity could improve the estimate. So when we finish a paper, it's close to Halloween. So just add just like one exotic possibility you could consider. Such a scenario, you have a ghost source. What do you mean by that? If you could detect a radio line signal above the astrophysical background, but you don't see any bright sources in either direction along the line of sight, so that maybe just because the source was very bright in the past, but now extends so much, emerges with the interstellar medium. So this may be also a way to do supernova remnant, find old supernova remnants, do supernova remnant archaeology, because it's more like a hypothetical and probably very difficult to achieve. But anyway, I just think it's fun. Okay. So thank you for attention.
Yeah. So the radio luminosity is 5 times the luminosity of the sun. So that will be 5 times 10 to the 33 hertz per second, mm-hmm. which is 3 orders of magnitude larger than the.
What was that?
It's essentially 10 to the 34 hertz per second in radio. 10 to the 30?
That's really? So this is 10 to 30. Okay, so yeah. so the benchmark peak is here. So it's close to 10 to 30. So you say that's really?
This is like a per root, per hertz.
Per hertz? Oh, that's per hertz. Okay. Okay. Yeah, what's the total luminosity then in your thing is?
Like
gigahertz
or tens of light times that.
Okay.
That's it's still a valid question. How about the sun, right? If you get
The sun, we do look at sun, but the issue of the sun is the issue with the sun. Okay, if I could remember, we do look at the sun for a week at least. the thing is the motion of the sun. Like the sun is too close to us, I think that screws up the signal. Could I recall the reason?
Your angular size is too big.
Extremely extended source, right?
Yeah, it's extremely extended source, and I think like the.
Couldn't you use like single events like? What gives you X-rays? I think like solar flares, for example, where you maybe you can pinpoint it.
But then it will probably reflect the stuff in the solar system. You can get lots of reflection probably as well, because everything here is based on. I mean, the background would be anything reflects right back to you. That's a better.
So I guess we thank Gigi again.